Welcome to Climate Emergency Manchester and to January 2024. It's the first January since the hottest year on the record, after the hottest year on the record, after the hottest year on the record. It's the anti-penultimate January, if we're lucky, before the city's carbon budget runs out in 2027. And it's election year, and climate action is a thorn in the side of both major parties, who are happy with the pledges and soundbites, but less so when it comes to funding them. That's right, it's Groundhog Day once again, and we're here to share our hopes and prayers for the future of the city, our country, and the rest of humanity. My name's Simon, and I'm joined by Chloe and Adam.
Hi, nice to be here. First Helen. Podcast of 2024. Mm. First podcast with carpet.
Luxury carpet, hello. Yeah.
And I've learned a new word.
We're in my house, but we've moved upstairs to the bedroom. Yeah. Study on now. This is the one room with all of the soft furnishings, so hoping the sound will be better. Plus, it's January, and this is one of the cozier rooms. Otherwise, we promise we'll be on our best behaviour.
I don't like any connotations right there.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say anti-penultimate.
Anti-penultimate, that was the word. I was listening out for it. So that means the one before the penultimate.
The one before the one before.
One before the one before. Yes.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it would be... What's before penultimate?
This is before penultimate.
Oh, yes.
Anti-penultimate.
Yeah, one before penultimate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Today,
it's an educational podcast.
It is. We're all learning completely useless words. Today we're going to cover a couple of key events since last summer. In November we had the latest update on the city's carbon budget and the latest results of the Climate Emergency UK scorecards, assessing all the local authorities in the country into a league table. In 2021, Manchester City Council came top of the tree. So did they hold on to that top spot? We will see. And as well as that, we'll talk about whatever's on our minds. I've been reading and listening on why mining's the reason the Green Revolution won't happen like everyone thinks it will. And I'm going to dig into Chloe and Adam's brains to see what leaks out. I have to apologise as well. So like all of my podcast intros, there was some hyperbole. And I already have to correct myself. So 2023 was the hottest year on record. But 2022 and 2021 weren't. I think 2016 and 2020 were the next hottest after 2023. That said, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the US, the 10 warmest years in the historical record have all occurred in the past decade. That's 2014 to 2023. So I think the hyperbole fits.
It's getting hotter.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's staying hotter and we're not going to go anywhere. This is only going to get warmer.
I got that sense that every time you hear on the news, this is the hottest insert week, month, year on record. It's like, but hang on, wasn't yesterday or
day.
Last week? It's just getting hotter and hotter. And so we are only seeing records on records on records.
Do you think that's going to make people less sensitive? Or I guess the only thing is whether it's actually starting to affect people properly. Like, you know, was it 2 years ago we had the hottest day on record and it smashed records, didn't it? Certainly, like, I don't really want to experience 36 degree 38 degree heat in Manchester
every year,
or every 5 years. It's still pretty nasty.
You also get that parochial thing where in the UK we didn't have a particularly hot summer this year. We didn't have the 36 degrees this year, so there's a section of population that need to be reminded that globally it was the hottest year.
We've gone back to climate change. What climate change? It's cold outside.
But it might start to lose its effect as a news headline, hottest year on record, just putting it that way.
Potentially. Let's start with the carbon budget. And I've spoken quite a lot. So my question before we get into the report that we'll discuss is, why was the carbon budget ever important?
Do I need to buzz in? It felt like a quiz question.
Yeah, it did feel like we should have a buzzers or a ding, a bell.
There are no wrong answers.
Why was the carbon budget important? It was launched to big fanfare. It marked the start of the cycle that we're just at maybe coming to the end of a new wave of at least the council paying lip service to it. It was a big step in terms of accountability as well. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, I think the accountability is the big thing, because I think it gave Manchester a set budget that would be its fair share of emissions based on historical data of what we've emitted in the past, and taking into account the climate negotiations. Like, it was set by an independent body. It was the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change, University of Manchester. So it wasn't, it was based and grounded in the science. So that was quite important. So it wasn't just plucked out of thin air. It was actually science-based, best science-based. So I think that's accountability is key, isn't it? And that's what we're trying to do here in this podcast, is sort of still give a certain level of accountability. But whether the budgets mean anything is another thing, isn't it? It's tons of carbon emitted based on historical data. It's a way of planning. It's potentially a planning aid if you think about what we should be doing or how we can actually use that up. But
yeah, so if you saw it as a monetary value, 15 million tons to 15 million pounds, we want to get from where we are now to this wonderful new place that is going to be net zero, and we've got 15 million pounds to get there. Shall we spend 10 million of that doing things that don't get us any closer to our future? Yeah. Or is it better to use that to actually move us in the right direction? That's the thing I don't think enough of the discussion has been around of. This is a budget that includes all of the activity we need to get to that future state. So carbon that we have to emit in order to do that. You know, building a wind farm, for example, solar power panels, electric cars, all emits carbon. So it's that budget that allows us to get where we need to be. But if we fritter it away on stuff that doesn't benefit us at all, then we are going to go over it.
Yeah, I'd say where the budgetary parallels with money maybe sort of diverge a bit is where, if you keep money in a bank, whatever interest rate, it's still in the bank. Whereas I guess carbon budgets will be consumed in a business as usual scenario. So if we do nothing, we're going to emit even more than if we do something. So I guess, yeah, that's where I guess the budgetary types of, I see there isn't a parallel there, because, you know, we just people living day to day in their houses, whether it's well insulated or not, what source of heat they use, all that sort of thing. Actually, that will consume more carbon of the budget if nothing was happening in terms of like interventions than if something or some level of action was to be taken.
There's also no overdraft.
So we've talked about why it was important when it was set. We'll get to actually what the report contained in November and what the latest data. But what is important about the carbon budget now? An amount of it is gone. What is important about it now?
This does feel like an exam question.
What's important? You're going to have to give us a clue.
It's more like coaching questions. It's not. I don't have an answer for you.
Yeah.
It's more about. It was set. I guess the thinking I had when I wrote the question was, when it was set out, it was 15 million tons and an optimistic look at, you know, this is, we need to stay within that budget. Now with so much of it gone, and I think where we are now without this report, the latest thing was 43% of the budget gone. That changes your view. If your half of your budget is gone, why is it important to keep looking at how much of the budget is left? What does that change?
Well, that's what I was wondering about your question, where it was important and useful in the early stage, because it still had the potential as a way to galvanise action. But as more and more gets used up, I don't know how important it's... Or I don't know if it's still the best way to try and get people to bring action, because I worry that a defeatism will kick in quite soon.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing, isn't it? It's like, I guess it should hopefully spark a certain level of alarm that whatever action is happening at a council level, and you know, we've elected those councillors, or collectively as a group of Manchester citizens, we've elected those people. They should know what situation we're in when it comes to carbon budgets and how quickly it's disappearing. So I think there is still some function for me of still looking at the budget, because we should know where we are, how quickly it's going, and in all likeliness, how far we're going above it. Because I guess that also hopefully is linked to that accountability. Because if we have to then take things back for whatever reason in the future, if we want to still, you know, play our fair share, or if potentially future generations want to hold past generations to account for the situation they're in, then surely they should also have those budgets to hand to know how far they've gone over and how little action has been taken. We could probably, you know, talk about the 1990s and the early 2000s as opportune moments when, you know, the many people that weren't in a position to be holding power to account, you know, if actors and politicians and whoever else took greater action then, we might not find ourselves in the situation we do now, or potentially even worse situation of the future.
And this is what they signed up for, how they were going to measure their own progress. So that's why we should stick to it. And also because I think there is a danger that it gets dropped when it's convenient as well. So by saying, oh, it's not important, how can it help us to do anything when we're so close to leaving, it might play into the hands of those who it's just convenient to drop it. So almost by keeping it alive, keep reminding of it, it makes it more difficult for some people who think, right, we can drop it and try and find another one so we can start again and the cycle can begin again.
And maybe the other thing is, you know, it's rooted in the science. The amount of concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere is directly linked to the amount of warming or heating or boiling, as I think the UN General Secretary said, is going to happen. So, you know, climate change is cumulative. So the higher concentrations of CO2, the greater the effect associated with global warming, global heating or boiling. So, yeah, that's also part of that. So it's directly linked to the international budgetary process. It's directly linked into climate science and what we understand of how we've altered the atmosphere and how we've altered our weather systems.
Okay. So let's get into the report itself. This came to scrutiny in November. And this is the annual update on emissions data. And it came in November, which was a separate submission to the annual update from the Manchester Climate Change Partnership. Normally these two are together. So the partnership presents its activities for the year and includes the emissions data for that year. And I thought that was quite interesting that they did their bit in October, but they didn't have the data ready, so they submitted it separately in November. It seems a little bit strange that for anyone who doesn't know what the partnership is, it's we have a 3-minute explainer podcast. I think it's episode 3. I thought it was interesting that the scrutiny of the Climate Change Partnership was separate from the emissions report.
I agree. It leads to an even stranger effect. This is usually a weird item anyway in terms of the responses, but even in terms of the paperwork, it's now completely divorced from any sense of who is going to do anything about it.
Yeah. So for anyone who's new to these annual emissions data reports, it covers the city's direct energy-related emissions, this one for 2021, plus an estimate for 2022. And it's based on the latest national data from the UK government and pulled down. So it's 2 years behind us every time it's presented.
It's like a little time machine.
Yeah. Adam, do you want to take us through what the report shows in terms of Manchester, consumption and how it compares with Greater Manchester authorities?
So I think it says total emissions, Manchester's the highest. So of the 10 boroughs that make up Greater Manchester, but it doesn't, in terms of emissions per capita, it has the lowest, second lowest of the whole of the 10 boroughs. So essentially, when you divide total emissions by the number of people in the area, that's where you get that figure of per capita emissions. That's because they think, and I think this is all a little bit speculative, I wouldn't say, you know, we have total emissions that are highest because obviously it's the sort of commercial and cultural and employment centre of the city region. It's called Greater Manchester for a reason, I guess. But yeah, it's not the same as, say, Trafford, that has a huge industrial estate on it. It's predominantly going to be people working in offices or possibly working at home. It hasn't got the sort of heavy industry that might be directly emitting because it's using lots of energy. It's quite interesting around what they're talking about when it comes to sort of the per capita emissions, because it's second lowest. It's sort of 14% below the average in Greater Manchester, so it's 3.4 tons of carbon per person rather than 4, which is what the average is for Greater Manchester, and sort of 20% below 4.5 tons of the national average. They sort of speculate a bit on why they think that might be. There's a lot of self-congratulatory sort of reasons that they put in there about well-connected public transport infrastructure, presence of lower emission industries, improved placemaking to accommodate growth ambitions. I don't know how that relates to sort of the disparity. And then it sort of talks about socioeconomic disparities, which most people might know as poverty, and says that, I guess, unequal distribution of economic benefits. So again, lots of poor people living in the same area may play a role in why the emissions are lower per capita per person than, say, some other areas in the national average. So it's quite interesting. I think they say there needs to be further research done in that area, but I can't see the city, Climate Change Agency really having a serious look at that. But maybe some academics might be interested in that in terms of looking.
And if they did, we'd probably get it in about 3 years' time, just as the carbon budget runs out.
Pretty much, yeah, probably, if they get the funding.
They'll do a pilot study on it.
Okay, so do you want to talk us through the results for the latest
budget?
Yeah.
In terms of where we're at.
Where are we at? So the last report we had, and we've been using this stats for the last 12 months, 43% of the budget was gone. Where are we up to now?
Should we allow a moment for listeners to guess?
Yeah, listener, 43% gone already in, what are we talking?
So that was reported
4 years, 5 years.
Yeah, since 2018. So that was reported last year using the 2020 data.
So 43% had gone. What do we think is a reasonable guess? I actually did this on WhatsApp with a few friends.
Oh, good.
And a couple of them were really far below, and someone went really pessimistic.
Interesting. Interesting. No prizes, but it's still.
So we have a 15 million ton carbon budget, haven't we? Up to 2030. Well, it's 30-year carbon budget, I think, the 15 million tonnes. And we emitted 9.5 million of that already. So that's 63%.
Yowza.
Ouch.
So this is a carbon budget that is meant to last us to zero carbon, as the council call it, in 2038. And then last us to the end of the century.
The end of the century.
Well, I think, so we need to get to zero by 2030. Yeah, and then basically, yeah, we should be at zero, no net at least. And certainly, you know, we're removing anything that we are still emitting by that point. But yeah, first 5 years, 63% of that 30. There is a steep curve in this report as well, isn't there?
Mm.
And we start, you know, I guess the pandemic played as a certain role in like severely dropping that. But in terms of estimated where they're at, there was a bit of a bump up.
But we still weren't. So 2020 was the closest we came to meeting our annual reductions, but we still didn't meet them.
No.
No.
But
we've talked about that on previous podcasts, of that's the sort of scale of action you would need. But you'd need that every year.
Year on year. And
not,
you need
not
to
necessarily lock down in our homes, but that scale of change every year.
So we're now in 2021, which probably saw a return to, certainly more return to car journeys. Collective sigh.
Yeah. Yeah, and the estimated emissions in this is not like inspiring, like we're on a massive downward trend again. Mm. It ticked up and now they think it's moderately reducing, but it's not like it's going to be a sharp decline again. You know, that's because, again, yeah, there's going to be some, I'd say, probably business as usual things like people changing their cars, going from petrol powered to EVs, especially on the sort of company car side of things, not so much when people have to actually pay for their cars properly. Then there's, you know, are people massively taking up heat pumps and retrofit? And
well, let's get into that. So Chloe, you've got the sectoral analysis for 2021, so that's which sectors of society and the percent of the city's total emissions that they emit.
So they break it down into five sectors, and three of them are smaller players, right? So all about the 10 to 15%. That's the industrial sector. We know that the, you know, the centre of Manchester is not as heavily industrial as, say, Trafford. Commercial, so that's electricity and gas use in non-industrial business. That's also 11%. Public sector, 15%. So they're the three smaller ones. And there are two big hitters, both about a third. So domestic was accountable for 33%, bang on a third. And then transport, 29%. In the paperwork, it also says that domestic is absolutely the same as the national average. So nationally, it accounts for a third as well. But transport is higher. So our 29% transport is higher than the national average. The papers frame it as something around as being a transport hub, yada, yada, yada. Like, you could also look at it as that's the one that we need to do something about because it's higher than the national average.
Yeah. What I noted as well was the overall, so it summed up the different sectors, but then said overall the energy use in our buildings. So that's across all of those different sectors, whether it's a residential home or a commercial building. Energy use in our buildings account for 76% of emissions and ground transport for 24%. So it's a different way of slicing the data. But that gives an idea of that energy use in buildings is 3/4.
Yeah.
And remember, the thing that we're not talking about is the things that we buy.
Like, this doesn't
account for this. Yeah, this doesn't emissions. Account for that. So this is just direct emissions that we're talking about. So that's your fuel use and your electricity use. Mm-hmm. So,
but yet again, whichever way you slice it, buildings and transport just keep coming out.
And that came up as my first question that had, as we start a new year, what has changed and what hasn't?
I don't think, if you look at this report, I don't think you can tell much has changed apart from they're reporting more depressing figures.
Nothing here was changed. Nothing here was a surprise. If I'd been on your WhatsApp group, I would have, you know, maybe I wouldn't have got the exact percentage right. Maybe I'd have hovered around 60. Maybe I'd gone as high as 70. But nothing much has changed, which does make it quite difficult to know when these land in meetings, what are the people that are have heard this before, what are they going to say in response? There were some questions when this was presented at the scrutiny committee meeting about what would the response to this be. Make some lip service to action needs to happen at a different degree of urgency and a different scale, but the room fell fairly flat after that. There was nothing that could be said.
Yeah, so this And their estimates for 2022, they're still looking at a hole between what they predict would be annual emissions of 1.8 million tonnes and what they need in terms of a target to remain on budget, which is 1.1 million tonnes. So that's 700,000 tonnes of carbon, pretty much.
And so when this was presented at scrutiny, as I say, the previous years it's been presented by or with the annual update from the Manchester Climate Change Partnership. Was there anyone from that partnership in the room?
There was Samantha Nicholson.
The climate change agent.
Yes, she was there. So she partly spoke about it.
And that's their role to report in this way. But the Climate Change Partnership is the group of businesses that are responsible for those emissions or a proportion of those emissions. And for me to have that data on the table and not have them in the room is a failure of accountability and scrutiny.
It shows that you're just doing this almost for reporting's sake. You're not actually expecting something to happen as a result of it. Okay, we've got this scheduled, we have to have it on, but you're not expecting anything to happen there. There was I think it was a council officer who did a big sigh and said, maybe we need to look at a different approach. And he was talking about everyone's favourite, the carrot or stick, saying that what they had, yeah, what a classic divide, that they'd carroted up until now, but maybe it was time to consider
wielding that stick.
Carrots and sticks. Did they also maybe ponder what came first, the chicken or the egg? You know, these are all the big hitting conversations, I think.
Yeah. And then, you know, and so this was the sophistication of the debate that followed in terms of carrots and sticks. Samantha Nicholson said that, you know, the partnership was, you know, it was really a carrot organisation. So sticks were not palatable to them. Their approach was all grounded.
All carrot. Who's the stick organisation then?
Well, I need to go back and check who it was, but it was interesting. It wasn't a voice I didn't know, and it was someone who worked for the council, that he even when faced with these figures, he said, maybe, you know, as much as it pains me to say, maybe it is time for the stick. But that was said with a weary...
I'm really trying not to... We do need to mark a podcast as using certain language...
Explicit language.
Explicit is the right, yeah. And I am trying to rein it in. But my God. My God. You have to get rid of 2/3 of your budget before you start thinking, should we maybe get a stick?
So it's quickly reined in, but sticks did make an appearance, despite there being some... Carrot advocates still in the room.
And without really getting into, difficult to say, I know, without getting really into any of the policies or changes or things that have come in recent years, what are the key campaigns, projects or policy changes that MCC or perhaps with the combined authority need to focus this year and beyond to try and
Well, surely, like, it needs to be reducing the amount of energy that people use in buildings, people and businesses use in buildings, and reduce the amount of emissions coming from transport. So possibly looking at ways to disincentivize people using fossil fueled cars. Surely, like, you would think of that, and potentially trying to decarbonize public transport as quickly as possible. So more electrified buses, not just for air quality, but actually to reduce the amount of emissions that are going on from that, you know, that side of things.
Any thoughts to add?
No, I think the data has given you those two areas. So for the next year, stop messing around with everything else and just focus on those two for now.
Yeah, it's going to be really, I think it's very difficult when you start to get into the nuts and bolts when it comes to how to do that in buildings, for example.
Mm, yeah.
Like, I don't think we've really got there, because whenever you start opening up the can of worms that is retrofit, mm. when it comes to, like, there are huge opportunities, but we haven't cracked it when it comes to actually, you know, beyond putting some loft insulation or telling people to heat their homes, if they can, you know, slightly cooler than maybe they would otherwise. What are we actually able to, you know, do rapidly?
Yeah.
And the reason they would say for recent years hasn't been as rapid as it needs to be is a hostile government.
Yeah, that came, that old chestnut came up again.
Of course. What sense do you get? We can't go into it for too long, but what sense do you get being an election year that a change of government would represent a rapid change to that situation?
Well, looking at what the pledges are, and, you know, even this investment gubbins that Labour have currently signed up to, may change by Groundhog Day, yeah. Who knows? You know, that won't be until the second half of the Parliament, so we're still, that would still be 2.5 years away. You're looking at minimum, you know, 2 more years of pretty much business as usual. So all that can tell is, you know, pretty much the budget will be gone by the time people will start to actually have anything, if they do decide to, you know, do anything in that area by, what was that, 2026? Isn't it? So, like, the budget would have pretty much gone by that point.
This is the problem with the attitude that I saw when I was dipping into some of the scrutiny committees this morning. There is a feeling amongst some people that they just have to kind of wait for a few months, and by some point this year, everything is going to be better. Yes, we've so long of moaning about national government, but the attitude seems to be nearly there, nearly there. It's nearly all over. Is the feeling.
Tory horror show.
It felt different the way that they were talking about national government previously, but still, like, still a state that, well, it could be the end of this, it could be towards the end of this year where there is a change of government anyway. Things that don't get on stream until 2-3 years into this, it isn't nearly over. We could be looking at things that, at best, start
26, 27. Yeah. Which will be when budget, that will be budget end day, pretty much. I think that will be budget blind.
Generally, I know that we will end up talking about national government more, because the excuse that local government, in Manchester at least, has often said is we don't have an amenable national government to be able to make these changes. When that goes away, well, in theory, when it goes away, when they have if they have a Labour government nationally, we'll have a whole new space to critique them on, because they won't have that hostile government. I actually think the government will be quite hostile still, because they still say that we're not going to give you the money if it, you know, messes with our treasury rules.
There is no money. As what ultimately,
yeah, I think
you,
you think
that's
about
what you're
what,
here.
Yeah, and you think about what's currently being rumoured in terms of, like, the Tory tax giveaway. Mm. You know, essentially all they're doing is a bit of national vandalism to the public budgets just before whoever, you know, what the inevitable might happen, which would be a Labour government come in, which would just box them in a little bit more.
Yeah, yeah. On the one hand, it's a sweetener they hope will win them the election.
A bribe,
on the other
possibly?
Hand, it's a trap for...
Yeah.
I think there's some people there who don't even think it's a sweetener. They just think of it as a good bit of slash and burn.
Yeah, I think a little bit of scorched earth policy is going to go on, you know.
Yeah.
It's a fiscal scorched earth policy. It's not you know, you're not. It's not the same as what Putin's doing in Ukraine, but it's pretty reckless to be doing this.
Yeah, war criminal or just a really spoilt child that knows it can't get what it wants and just wants to smash things up for the child.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
The child that comes
that's
afterwards.
A good analogy, maybe not so harsh on the Tories as I am. When it comes to scorched earth policy. But yeah, I think, like, it is a bit of childish. We'll break this because we're not going to be here for a long time. So we might as well
break it. As we can't have it ourselves, we might as well break it
if
for the next
one. If we can't play with those toys, no one can. Therefore, we'll break it a bit further. Yeah. Which is thoroughly depressing.
What a way to finish this segment of the podcast. To sum that up, we aren't in a good place. We've used 2/3 of our carbon budget. There's no new news here. It's going, we've not got any big projects in the pipeline that are going to give us a sign that that's going to change. And even a new government at the moment doesn't give us that hope either. We hope, beyond hope, that they are somehow just trying, taking this line to get elected, and then they will change tack. But firstly, I would say that that's a vain hope. But even if it were true, how is that the politics that we have today, where you have to outright lie to get elected? Why are we okay with a politics like that? It is quite a pessimistic view.
Yeah, I think my counter to that, we shouldn't really rely upon these supposed powerful people in government to try and dig us out of this situation. I think we have to rely on each other, really, and realise that no one furthermore with supposed power or insight is going to save us. You know, this isn't something we should really put in the, you know, there's obviously they have a responsibility, but at the same point, we also have a responsibility not to rely on them to sort of predetermine our future. And if we don't like it, we should make sure that they are pressured to know that we don't like it and we want better. And again, holding them to account is definitely part of that, and whatever way we can do that. But also, you know, there has to be a level of, you can't abdicate all individual responsibility as well. So there is a balance between collective systems level responsibility and also individual responsibility for individual actions where we can take them.
Interesting angle that, and I think it's one we're going to follow up with maybe in February, because one of our other colleagues has been talking about personal guilt and environmental guilt for the emissions that we have to or are choosing to emit, and how that relates into system change, and something we'll explore more. But the idea that, yes, I think it is system change, but as you say, reflecting, if the system changes, individuals live in that system. They have to choose how they're going to react to that. We've seen system changes where individuals are banded together to try and shut it down, like the Clean Air Zone in Manchester. We need to decide as individuals how radical we are prepared to be, how much change are we prepared to embrace, and at the very least, yeah, not to try and shut it down and stop it happening. Unless there's a very good reason. That's it for the first segment. We're going to come back with looking at Climate Emergency UK and their second round of scorecards, looking at Manchester and how it compares to other councils around the country. So we will be right back.